The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the January 11th, 2014 edition of my Saturday afternoon program. Today is a warm January day where I live. The temperature is going to hit 70 degrees, it's supposed to, and it's quite warm out there right now. Some people will no doubt be boating out on the lake. But it's not spring yet. I think it will get cold again and many more times before the winter is over. But I do hope that deep, deep Arctic chill doesn't form again this year. Today, I received the first donation for the January 27th project. It was from a regular contributor, Dimitar, who I've mentioned many times before, and it just covered the monthly server costs. See how that works? It always works out, and I hope it is the first of others to come because there are also administrative costs and the server cost every month. Well, Ariel Sharon died yesterday. I wasn't going to even mention it, but I just checked to see if I could find out any facts about how he died. I don't know that they say he was in a coma. They don't say he was on life support. I guess I've always imagined that he's been on life support for this 8 years, but I guess not. So that explains how he could just die without them pulling the plug on him. I don't know. We don't know the truth about that. But what I did find out, which is important to me, is that he was the son of Russian immigrants. So he's a Russian Jew, and they are the worst of their race, according to Reverend William Carter, public lecturer for the Board of Education in New York City back in the early part of the 20th century. Excuse me. Hadding Scott and I were reading about that in Henry Ford's International Jew on Thursday, and we were reading this story about how Carter was complimentary to the Jews, but he did say that the Russian Jews and it was predominantly Russian Jews who were emigrating to the United States and being allowed in were the worst of their race, he put it, or the worst of the Jews. And he got into all kinds of trouble. And it's a very interesting story about what the Jews did to him and trying to shut him up and shut everybody up from talking about their dear selves. So I would recommend that. But here we have Ariel Sharon. He is naturally, not surprisingly, a Russian Jew. Now, my topic today is why the Holocaust, as Carlos Porter calls it. He calls it the Hoxacost, but I'm calling it the Holocaust, has to go. And that word cost, the last part of the word is spelled, being spelled C-O-S-T, cost, that says it all. The cost is too high. This is not up for debate. You know, some will say yes, some will say no, but it is and it must be an absolute. It cannot be tolerated. I'm going to explain that a little bit today. Last Saturday, though, Andrew Anglin was on this program with me, and I just want to say that it has become clearer and clearer to me over the past year that of all the white activists out there with radio programs and websites and people doing various things and all good people, very good people, but my own idea of how things need to be presented comes closest to what Andrew is doing. well, we talked about it a little bit, but I'm seeing it. I feel that the Daily Stormer that he created and is keeping going really well. I mean, it hasn't dropped in quality or in the intensity of it or the amount of information on it at all. He's doing a great job of keeping it up to and getting better, actually. And so that's important. But, I mean, I think now that that Daily Stormer is something that we couldn't do without. That's how I feel about it. I mean, it's telling a story that needs to be told in a way that is just straight out and without any hesitation or equivocation. And so this is what I think we need to do. And I've been talking like that for a long time, although I don't do the kind of thing that that Andre is doing. But I think this is true with the Holocaust. It's wrong. It's a wrong thing. It's causing us so much damage, and it serves our enemies. And so I'm going to point out some current examples of this. I'm calling it Reasons Why the Holocaust, C-O-S-T, has to go. Overall reason, as I already said, is in that word itself, that it costs too much. And the first cost is truth. Just yesterday, there was an editorial in the New York Times written by the editorial board. It said, "Why Nazi Hunting Remains Crucial." That was the title of it. And I thought, gee, you know, what if we wrote an editorial in some publication of ours that said, "Why Jew Hunting Remains Crucial?" I mean, it's just a judgment as to whom is bad. Why shouldn't, if Nazis can be hunted down, because certain people don't like them or think that they did bad things. Well, look at all the bad things the Jews did. God, you could make a case from here to eternity about the bad things Jews have done. And all these bad Jews and there's all kinds of crimes being committed right now, even by respectable Jews, like in the Federal Reserve and in our Treasury Department and in so many other departments and all in every government. Why don't we go start hunting Jews? And why couldn't we say, well, you know, Jew hunting is crucial to carry out? Well, this New York Times editorial was very short, so I'm going to read it. It said, "Sooner or later, time will run out in the pursuit of Nazi-era war criminals as they are overtaken by death after decades of undeserved freedom." All right. So, you know, there you have it. Even the New York Times, and you know, on this editorial board, I wonder, is probably, it might not be all Jews, but maybe nine-tenths Jews, and the Jews were the ones who wrote this, or a single Jew, but they don't deserve this freedom they've had. You know, in 1945 and after, and they didn't kill and torture and destroy enough German National Socialists to satisfy themselves. They have had to keep it up all these years, trying to get every last one that they can identify as having been a National Socialist and being above the level of a private or something, I guess. Even in the armed forces, you have just soldiers, Wehrmacht troops who they want to get after, but mostly anybody who was in the SS they want to get. And they can't stand it that these people might die a natural death and have escaped their judgment all these years. So they go on and say, "This makes it all the more noteworthy that an 88-year-old German man was charged this week with the murder of 25 people in a wartime massacre in the French village of Ordor-sur-Glane. The case, prosecuted by German authorities, is a reminder of a haunting period of history that must be kept in mind as fresh acts of genocide bedevil the world. In the French massacre, SS troops shot and burned to death 642 people. Well, that is a lie. I mean, that whole thing is really not true, but in many parts of it, but there was SS troops did not shoot and burn to death 642 people. And this included, they say, you know, all these innocent civilians. That story has been done, and of course the main person who understands that and has written about it is now my brain just went dead trying to think of Vincent Renoir. Vincent Renoir of Paris, France, the esteemed French revisionist. So that's all been taken care of, but they don't acknowledge the truth about that. And so there's their first lie in this editorial. Then they say, anyone tempted to relegate such slaughter to the deep past needs to know of a current development that hardly seems unrelated. The surge in e-book readership of Mein Kampf, Hitler's blueprint for the mass extermination of European Jews. Well, there's another lie. It was not a blueprint for the mass extermination of European Jews. That's not why Hitler wrote it. It's not what's in the book. But that's what they say, these stupid people. You see, they're upset by that. They're upset. They're so upset that people still, and even in increasing numbers now, want to know about Hitler and Mein Kampf. They want to go to the original sources. They want to find out what it's really all about. They're not satisfied to just listen to the propaganda anymore. And this is very much disturbing the Jews. And they say the ebook version of the work was reported this week to be the top seller on the Amazon political psychology list. The phenomenon shows that more than ever, people need to know of the genocide rooted in Hitler's ideas. Now, that's a lie, okay? There was no genocide rooted in Hitler's ideas at all. So there's three lies in this two paragraphs so far, and they end this sentence by saying, and those facts need to be detailed in trials. This is important. They want to bring all these people to trial, as many as possible, so that they can, in fact, turn their lies into what seems factual, into established truth, because it was found to be so, it was accepted and so on in a court of law. And so that's another reason why they want to have trials. And that's a reason why we should not want them to be able to bring these people to trial. And of course they've brought a lot of revisionists to trial, court trial, and they've gotten from that the idea that if you disagree with what they say, their Holocaust-genocide was, that you are in fact a criminal and you are guilty of hate crimes and so on. We're going to look a little bit more at these hate crimes. So the editorial goes on, since 2001, there have been more than 100 successful legal actions against Nazi war criminals. See how they're bragging? According to the Simon Wiesenthal Center, the Nazi hunting organization, they are totally unapologetic that this Simon Wiesenthal Center should be called a Nazi hunting organization, because they're so totally steeped, and they believe their readers are steeped in the idea that anything Nazi is bad, 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 in every way, you know. So you can't say anything too bad about Nazis. You can't insult Nazis. I've seen that before. You can't slander them. You can't, there's no laws that protect Nazis. And of course, Simon Wiesenthal was one of the biggest liars. He was an Austrian Jew, not a Russian Jew. But they're pretty bad too, from Vienna. And he was one of the biggest liars in historical revisionism. And it's known. And yet that doesn't diminish this man in the eyes of the industry, where they keep, you know, promoting him as a great person because he was a Nazi hunter. And they go on and say dozens more have been prepared. That is, dozens more legal actions have been prepared. But Wiesenthal Center workers say that most of this stuff comes out of the Wiesenthal Center. That's another thing that should be gone, done away with. These workers say other nations are not as committed as Germany to following through on this obligation to do justice. No, this obligation of justice. So, yeah, that's good. Of course, they can get Germany to do all this stuff, but they can't get, because it's in Germany's national charter, so to speak, and when it, you know, was able to form a government again after the war, that, you know, that they are committed to anything that will condemn and do away with Nazism. So that's part of their national, I'm calling it a national charter, but that's not exactly correct terminology. But but other countries don't want to be told that they have to bring all these, you know, have all these trials and so on. They're not that gung-ho about it, which is good. But then they have in parentheses here, they have to bring up, since this was from yesterday, just yesterday this appeared, I think it was, they have to bring up Dieudonné in France, and they say there in France the government has been aggressive in attempting to block crowd-baiting appearances by Dieudonné Mbala Mbala, a controversial comedian who has been convicted after using anti-Semitic hate speech in his routine. Well, see, they got on this right away, because he, I don't know when he was convicted. I guess he's been convicted. But this thing, I'm going to mention a story about that, too, in a minute. So we'll wait on that. But you know how they say that he is convicted about anti-Semitic hate speech. They're focusing there on anti-Semitism. Then they say the Nazi hunt must continue, particularly since life expectancy is rising. Huh. According to Ephraim Zuroff, director of the Wiesenthal Center's Israel office. Now that Ephraim Zuroff, he's as bad as Simon Wiesenthal, who you should know is now dead, thank goodness. But Ephraim has taken over. But they say he's director of the Israel office, but he has a lot of influence, and he's been known as the term that he's described by is the Nazi hunter. He's been the main Nazi hunter for the Wiesenthal Center for quite a while, and he's quoted as saying, and they always quote him every time they talk about anything to do with Jews or anti-Semitism, they run to him and quote him when they don't quote anybody on, you know, of the opposite persuasion. But he says, I'm one Jew who prays for good health for these fugitives. See, these people are so bloodthirsty that they can't stand it if some of these old Nazis might live longer and they're not going to be brought to trial. They can't stand it. They got to get every one of them. And he's hoping that they'll have good health so that he can go out and hunt for them and bring them to justice and put them in jail, in prison. And then they say, that's the end of this editorial, but then they say at the bottom in little bitty type, a version of this editorial appears in print on January 11th, that's today, 2014, in the International New York Times, which reminded me that this international paper used to be called the International Herald Tribune. And it's a very popular paper in Europe and overseas and probably all over what's called the free world, because it gives news of all around the world in English for Americans or English-speaking people who are living overseas. And it focuses, you know, like if it's in Germany, it focuses on a lot of German issues. If it's in France, it focuses on a lot of French issues, or in Japan, same thing, you know. But at the same time, it gives a survey of world news. And it used to be called that, and at some point in 2013, I think. It's been owned by the New York Times for a long time, and that the New York Times finally got rid of the name Herald Tribune and put their own name on it. So now it's called the International New York Times. So stories like this, they put in that international paper too, which has a very large circulation and goes to people that the New York Times wouldn't get to. All right, the cost of this Holocaust is both in money, which I'll get to, but also in public relations and in our legal right to defend ourselves. And this is very important cost. And another example of this is this story from the Telegraph in about the Dieudonné story. France wins battle to ban anti-Semitic comedian. And we find that in this story, it's all about anti-Semitism. You know, it's like what they want to ban in France is any anti-Semitism. Now, you know, you have to ask, really, why should people not be allowed in France to be anti-Semitic if they want to be? Or I guess you could say, well, they can be, but they can't speak about it. And they can't give public talks about it. But you can give public talks about all kinds of other anti-stuff, but not that. Now, I read here, it's been that this court, this ban on his performance by a high government court has been hailed as a victory over anti-Semitism. And it says the ban had been lifted only yesterday by a local judge. This would be 2 days ago today. A local judge said that a perceived risk to public order could not be used to justify a radical measure such as banning an entire performance, banning the show. So, but the next day, or maybe later that day, it went to France's highest administrative court, the Council of State, and they ruled that the show could go ahead without Dieudonné. And the Interior Minister of France, Manuel Valls, has led the campaign to ban the comedian's performance. Now, this Dieudonné is a black man, and he has been increasingly a Holocaust denier. He was a Holocaust critic, and he's just gotten increasingly more so, as far as I know. I can't say that for sure, but it seems at least he's gotten increasingly more publicity about it. And this Interior Minister of France says, "We cannot tolerate hatred of others, racism, anti-Semitism, or Holocaust denial. That is not France. This is a victory for the Republic." You know, you have to question why they can't tolerate racism or, you know, racial thinking, why they can't tolerate anti-Semitism or Holocaust denial. Why those particular things is what they can't tolerate. They tolerate many other things. They just approved of gay marriage. They tolerate all those Muslims in their country. They tolerate all kinds of acts against white French people. They tolerate lots of things, but this particular anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial, they can't tolerate. And they throw in racism because that's what fits in with anti-Semitism. So this article says that the decision marks a landmark break. The decision of this high court, with a legal precedent that was, you know, in France previously, where constitutional provisions on free speech were upheld, but now it's saying no, it doesn't apply if it's these particular things, if it's anti-Semitism. Now, following this, four cities in the south of France all banned Dieudonné's performance because this was, I think, one performance in one city that was being used in this court case. But now Dieudonné is appealing this high court decision, and many supporters of him say that he will win based on the law, because the law in France allows what he's doing under their freedom of speech provisions, and that if they go by the law, they can't do what they're doing. So this high court was persuaded to go against the law, and we'll see if they continue to be persuaded to do so. Because we see that happening all the time. France does not have the statements in its founding charter of statehood, because it doesn't have that new thing like the Germans have that says that they have to follow the results of the Nuremberg trial and so on. You know, they don't have that in France, so we'll see. But I would like to know. No, let's see. One more thing I want to say here. There's a prime minister of France, Jean-Marc Ayrault. I never heard of him, but he was happy with the Council of State ban, and he said this. Again, listen to this. What's at stake is a struggle against the drift toward anti-Semitism in which Dudenay was engaged. Over the course of time, each show leads to a spiraling out of control, and we can't accept that in our society. There is the slightest complacency with regards to anti-Semitism. It's totally alien to our values and principles. So the only thing he mentioned there is what was the problem. Twice he mentioned it was anti-Semitism, and of course, he calls it alien to our values and principles. Well, it's alien to Jews. So the values and principles. Well, I'd like to know why every government in the world, just about, or every government in the free world, what's called that, is participating in this fight against anti-Semitism. And the only answer that comes to my mind is that every government in the world, in the free world, is run by or is following policies laid down by Jews. Just think about that for a minute. Okay. Another cost is that of allowing Israel to menace the world with war fears, you know, and Israel, with its constant war drumming, is allowed because of this Holocaust. Two stories about this coming up, about Israelis and Israel lovers. Now, this first one is old news. It was published on December 18th. And it's about Elie Wiesel taking out his full-page ads in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal saying Iran must not be allowed to remain nuclear. This story that I'm taking this from is from the Allgemeiner.com. I hate the Allgemeiner. I didn't know they were as old as they were, or they had been around as long. As I read here somewhere that they've been around for, you know, like 20 years or more, or longer than that. I thought it was kind of new. I just saw it, not, you know, last year, and maybe they weren't, I don't know if they got online then. But in any case, they have this nice German name, Allgemeiner, but it's all Jewish. It's a totally Jewish paper. And it says, Professor Elie Wiesel, I should pronounce it, Wiesel. It's like a Z, Wiesel. Nobel Peace Laureate and the Allgemeiner Advisory Board Chairman. So they always say that he's a Nobel Peace Laureate, but I found out here that he's also the chairman of the advisory board for this horrible Allgemeiner newspaper, which is centered in Germany. And he said back then in December, and it's funny that this came out December 18th, right in the pre-Christmas festivities and, you know, anticipation and shopping and holiday and so on. Right then, in order to kind of like the Jews wanting to draw attention to themselves and their issues at this time of year. Anyway, he said, he wrote in this that, I'm just going to go on down to the, well, before I read it, I'm going to go through it real fast, but he said, I want to say a couple things about what it says about it. It said the ads were paid, these two ads in these two big, very expensive newspapers, New York Times and Wall Street Journal, were paid for by Jewish philanthropist, co-founder of Birthright Israel, Michael Steinhardt, and were produced by Rabbi Shmuley Boteach's This World, The Values Network. So there's two things I've heard. Of course, I've heard of Birthright Israel, very big organization that's founded by this Steinhardt and paid for by him. But I never heard of This World, The Values Network. Now, that's something that Rabbi Shmuley Boteach created. Now, I've heard of him. He's made quite gotten a lot of attention for himself. And so they obviously came up with this idea, and they got Elie Wiesel to cooperate with them. And either they wrote it and he kind of edited it or approved it, or maybe he wrote it and then they all worked it out together. But they do all this stuff. They prepare it for him, and then they ask him if he'll just, sign off on it and use his big famous name. So we don't know, but in any way, he did sign off on it. And in the ad, he says, Iran must not be allowed to remain nuclear. If there is one lesson I hope the world has learned from the past, it is that regimes rooted in brutality must never be trusted. And the words and actions of the leadership of Iran leave no doubt as to their intentions. Now, see, he's lying here. A regime's rooted in brutality. Iran may be guilty of some brutality, but not any worse or to the degree of Israel, although they like to say that Iran is brutal to its own citizens, and Israel is not. It's only brutal to... Well, it is brutal to if you... the ones who are citizens of Israel, but it is brutal to the Palestinians, and it would be brutal to anybody else that's not of their own people. So they think that makes Israelis better. But, liars can just ignore the reaction to their lies. And when people read this, they don't agree with it. And they, but they don't, the Jews don't care. They don't care if you don't agree with it. They just keep saying it anyway. The ad goes on to say, should the civilized nations of the world trust a regime whose supreme leader said yet again last month that Israel is doomed to annihilation and referred to my fellow Jewish Zionists as rabid dogs? So that's Elie Wiesel saying that he's speaking of his fellow Jewish Zionists, admitting he is a Jewish Zionist. Well, and of course, I don't know him too often calling himself a Zionist, but of course he always has been. And even as a young man, the first that we hear from him is in France, in those orphanage or those special homes for these Jewish kids. And he was a Zionist then. He was amongst the Zionist faction of these youths. He was no more than 17 at the time, 17 and then 18. In any case, he goes on and says some other yucky things. And then he says, should we who believe in life trust a regime whom our own State Department lists as one of the world's foremost sponsors of terrorism? Our own State Department, of course, he's just, he's U.S. He's a U.S. citizen. But, our State Department is run by Jews. Now we even have a Secretary of State who is a Jew, who is Jewish. And it's always been run by Jews. So that's a meaningless statement. And he goes on to say that America adopted him and gave him a home after my people were exterminated in the camps of Europe. He has to bring that up. And then he says that our nation, meaning the United States, is morally compromised when it contemplates allowing a country calling for the destruction of the state of Israel to remain within reach of nuclear weapons. Well, we've heard all this stuff before. But it's signed off, Elie Wiesel, Nobel Peace Laureate, and says this ad was produced by This World, the Values Network, and gives their logo, and Executive Director Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, sponsored by Michael Steinhardt, Board of Governors, This World, the Values Network, and co-founder of Birthright Israel. So Michael is on the board of Rabbi Shmuley's organization. You see how they all serve on these boards. They're board members. Well, Elie Wiesel is on that board too, and he's the chairman of the board. And they all serve together. You know, if they found their own organizations, then they serve on others. And they all get away with all this because of the Holocaust. Now, if it wasn't for the Holocaust, they'd still be doing a whole bunch of this stuff. They did it before. But they get away with a lot. And they appear to be in the moral, like here, it's hard to say that because the accent is not on the second syllable. And it's hard to use the Z without it. It really would be Wiesel. That's how you say it. I have a hard time saying that right. They wouldn't be able to take this moral high ground without the Holocaust that they take. And now another one is the story about releasing Pollard, Jonathan Pollard. It wasn't too long ago. Some 300 people staged a protest outside the David Citadel Hotel in Jerusalem, where Secretary of State John Kerry was staying during his visit to Israel, and they were demanding the release of Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard from American prison. Now, we all know about Pollard. We know that he should stay in prison for life. He probably should have been given the death sentence. But in any case, they're now getting more and more enthusiastic about trying to get him pardoned or released, whatever. And they say things like, 29 years is enough, and let Pollard go. And somebody said in this group, we simply cannot accept a situation in which dozens of killers are set free, whoever they are, while one of our own people is rotting in jail. One of our own people is rotting in jail. This was the student head of the student union of Bar Ilan University in Israel. And he was referring to Israel's release of Palestinian prisoners earlier this week. So Israel released some Palestinian prisoners, and they think that means they should be demanding the release of Jonathan Pollard. They like to say this, the time has come. The time has come for Pollard to return home. Well, they're going to keep this up. I will have to see, but it would be a horrible, horrible turn of events if this country, the United States, ever, or any president of the United States, decided to sign a pardon for this Jonathan Pollard, who, it has been said, was the most damaging spy of all time in all history of the United States. Now, I have a story on the distortion of history because of belief in the Holocaust. This is about the Katyn evidence. This is a recent story. I don't have the date of it, but the story was about a former American prisoner of war, Lieutenant Colonel John H. Van Vliet, Jr., last November, this testimony was given. Okay, this is January. All right. But he gave this testimony on May 10th, 1945. Okay. He gave testimony in 1945. But this woman has found a document that was considered lost. It was filed among other unrelated World War II documents, maybe on purpose, from the U.S. Embassy in Paris. It's a sworn deposition that provides evidence of Soviet responsibility for the 1940 massacre of some 22,000 Polish officers in the Katyn Forest and other places in the Soviet Union. And a few days ago, it says in this story, this is not that old of a story. I don't think it's from November. It's from just this past week or so. That Van, unless I looked it up and came upon it, I don't remember now, but this Van Vliet, a few days ago from this report, he was in Washington, there was another report that is considered missing, and this has fueled speculation that the U.S. government helped to cover up Soviet responsibility for the massacre at that time, which they did help cover up Soviet responsibility, and so did Great Britain, so as not to, as they put it here, anger Stalin, whom the Allies were counting on to help them defeat Germany and Japan in World War II. Now, you know, I just think it was so important. They put it out for the Allies to defeat Germany and Japan, so they had to be friends with Stalin. Well, it would have been more sensible to ally with Germany and defeat Stalin. I don't know about Japan. That's just something that Roosevelt got going on so that he could bring about a big war. But why wouldn't they ally with Germany to defeat Stalin? I mean, the whole United States saw communist Russians, the communist Soviet Union, as an enemy for years and years before that time, since 1918 and before that. But it didn't see Germany as such an enemy, except during, of course, World War I, which set the stage. But I mean, this whole reasoning is all because it's the way the Jews want it to be. And the Jews have so much power because they're able to use the Holocaust again and again and again to keep it. Now this woman, it's a woman named Piorkowska, who sounds Polish. She found this document, and she's made it public. And the background, Van Vliet was a POW in Germany at the time. This was in 1943 when this happened. And when the Wehrmacht came upon these mass graves in Katyn, they took him there. He was a POW, U.S. POW. They took him there to watch. They made him watch the whole thing so that he would be a witness to what they found and how they did it. He must not have been the only one, but he was a POW that they wanted to have there to tell the truth about it. And he tells about how 3,500 corpses were exhumed in tailor-made, little-worn Polish uniforms. That means they were kind of new. Because this was at the beginning of the war, and the Soviets, they didn't defeat anything, but they walked in and took over their half of Poland, and then they arrested all these officers, along with a bunch of others, and they were all killed with a shot to the back of the head, this Van Vliet says. He must be of Dutch ancestry. He said, and he also testified that the decomposition of the corpses and the nature of the undergrowth around that area was undisturbed. So that indicated that the bodies must have been there over a year and possibly 3 or 4 years. So that was done. You know, that's, again, proof of that it was the Russians who did it. And he says, the belongings that were removed from the corpses, you know, papers and letters and things like that, all indicated death in the months of February, March, or April 1940. So this is just important additional, not that it wasn't already known, but important additional information that got sidetracked somehow, his depositions on that by the Americans, but now has been discovered where it ever got sidetracked into. Okay, I'm going to move on to the claims conference. This is a story directly about the financial cost of the Holocaust. And there's it's not anything so very new, but it goes over all this, some interesting things in it. A former board member of the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany. And, of course, Jewish Material Claims Against Germany was initiated because of the Holocaust, and it's still there. They're still getting money from Germany, and they're still delivering it to Holocaust survivors all these years later, and some of it is not well accounted for. So a former board member of this conference wrote to a U.S. judge that that the organization was not well equipped to prevent fraud, and he had joined a group of American Holocaust survivors trying to block the distribution of these funds by the people who were in charge of doing so, the Jewish Material Claims Conference, actually, people. And they had 57, he brought out that $57 million was stolen from this organization through fraud. And then this former board member, now he's probably Jewish because he was on the board of the Jewish Material Claims Conference, and he's representing American Jewish survivors. So they're all Jews here, but they're arguing amongst themselves, he put out this petition that this fraud had been used against the claims conference, and that they were not equipped to fight this fraud in the future, that they didn't know how to do it. And so these American survivors created what they call the Holocaust Survivors Foundation USA, and they're challenging the distribution of $1.25 billion from a 1998 settlement with Swiss banks, which is money is going to be dispersed and distributed. You know, and these people deal in these large amounts of money. Now, I know that when we talk about Jews, other Jews in the financial areas, and like the Federal Reserve and U.S. Treasury Department and all these banks and so on, we're then dealing in trillions and trillions that they steal. So this is like a drop in the bucket, but still in all, $1.25 billion being given out to these various survivors and maybe survivor organizations. If, you know, even when it's in, even they're talking about million in one case, some 50 some million or so. If you know, that's a lot of money if people, and it's all going to these Jews, you know. It's all going to these Jews in the form of $500 a month, every month of their life, $700 or something like that, you know. And there's more and more that they keep adding to the list who deserve it. So it's not negligible. And so they're in this kind of battle, and it says here that as of July, the claims conference distributed $46.5 million to 80 social welfare agencies. And then they distributed more than, on a separate note, they distributed more than $262 million from this settlement to Jewish Nazi victims. That's what they call them. These people were not even real victims of the Nazis. They call them Jewish Nazi victims. Okay, so it's like, oh, they, you know, this Holocaust, again, the Holocaust was so true, and these people went through horrible, horrible, but so many of them managed to survive. What a miracle. You know, I don't know how. But they deserve everything that they can get from the country that the Nazis came from. So they're doing this, and some things that are interesting are that Menachem Rosensaft, general counsel for the World Jewish Congress and a law professor. Now, remember, general counsel for the World Jewish Congress, they get in on that. The World Jewish Congress has, well, they're the ones who arbitrated and negotiated these claims from the Germans in the first place, the World Jewish Congress. So I guess they still think they have a big part to play. And their general counsel said on Monday that the previous fraud case, and that's one that was well publicized, and I'm not, you know, we heard about that. A few people got sent to prison, not too much came from it. But at least there was a lot of good anti-Holocaust survivor publicity. But this previous case, general counsel said, is utterly, totally, and completely irrelevant to whether or not the distribution of the Swiss bank funds is being handled appropriately. That is, they're trying to, he said, the people who are wanting to stop it are talking about something totally different from this, and, you know, this is how they argue. So in recent months, the court divided up $50 million, now listen to this, with 75% of the money going to survivors in the former Soviet Union, and the rest going to other countries. The same formula previously used. So that this is the formula there that they are have been using. 75% of the money goes to Soviet former, not there now necessarily, former Soviet Union survivors, Jews. I mean, to the Russian Jews. To Russian Jews. 75%. The rest go as the other countries are divided up for the other 25%. And only about 4% would end up in the hands of United States survivors. So this fits in with what Henry Ford said that I brought up earlier, that the Russian Jews once are dominant. They've been dominant since 1918 or since the early part of the 20th century. The Russian Jews became dominant in the Zionist movement. And the Zionist movement became dominant over all the other Jewish organizations and interests and so on. And they still are. It's still, they still make it go their way. The Survivors Foundation said the court's determination is unfair to American survivors. Well, on the face of it there, it does sound like it. Maybe there's not as many survivors in the U.S. There's a lot of them. I don't know what the whole, why the formula is the way it is. But they're complaining about it. And somebody, this guy who was mentioned there, Corman, he's been mentioned a lot in here. In 2004, he wrote a 32-page rebuttal to the Survivors Foundation's proposals, reiterating that the survivors in the former Soviet Union represent the neediest people. So they say that these former Soviet Union survivors are the neediest. Well, as it was said last Thursday, and as Reverend Carter, who was a doctor of divinity, he's a doctor, not just a plain old church pastor, he said that the Jews, the Russian Jews are the worst of the Jews. And it seems that they are. And because they're the worst, they're the neediest, or they make themselves appear to be the neediest. And there's so darn many of them. There's so many of them. I had never had any idea how many Russian Jews came to the United States, but more than any other kind. So that's that story. And just in the few minutes before the break, I want to bring up that 2014 came to my attention is the 100th anniversary year of World War One. Not the 100th, yeah, the 100th, or the first century, the 100th. World War One, the Great War. So we are in the year now, 2014, 100 years from when the Great War broke out in 1914. which was the beginning of a lot of very terrible changes in the world. So, you know, this is a year to pay attention to that. It's not necessarily on my agenda, but I'm sure I could get some people on. I know somebody right now who would like to talk about World War One, and so maybe we'll do that sometime in the future, but not this month. This month I'm still focusing on Holocaust and getting ready for the big commemoration on the 27th, and we will go into that a little more in the next hour. And I'll just finish this off here by saying another little item I was thought I could talk about that I saw in Der Spiegel last night, an article, Europe's Unwanted People, The Plight of the Roma, and it had some horrible pictures there about Roma people in Germany. And, you know, my answer to that is, why call them Europe's Unwanted People? They're not European. That's why they're unwanted. They're not European. If they were, they would not be unwanted in Europe. So, you know, since they're not European, they shouldn't be in Europe. That's the simple answer to that. And all these troubles and problems that they're creating would be gone. Send them back to whatever kind of people they actually are. And things would be much better off. You know, I saw also a map showing how many Roma are in the different places in Europe. And, of course, Romania has the most. Wow. They have twice as much as what Hungary has, if not more than that. And they want to get rid of them. And they're allowed in the European Union. So now we've got all these Roma people, gypsies, creating the next big, huge problem. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'll see you in 5 minutes.
Ändert an deine Qual. Keiner kommt mehr hierher. Niemand vermisst dich mehr. Oh, es tut weh, wenn ich deinen Stein so seh. Treuer Soldat, mehr als ein namenloses Grab. Ich höre Stimmen, ich höre zum Gespräch. Du Kamera, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Sind im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Ich schwöre dir, so wahr ich hier stehe, ich trage die Fahne, wohin ich auch gehe. Nie werde ich euch verraten, für kein Geld der Welt. Ich kämpfe für dich. Ungebrochener Held, ich kämpfe für dich, unbekannter Held. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, ich höre das zu mir sprich. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimmt im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Und wer dann auch lügt, euer Namen benutzt, eure Heldentaten durch Geld hier beschmutzt, den trifft das Schwert von unsichtbarer Hand. Ein Totenwächter von Wotan gesandt. Ein Totenwächter. Schwarzen Gewand. Doch ich höre eine Stimme, die dann zu mir spricht. Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Und es ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Mit dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht. Kamerad, du siehst, wir stehen für euch ein. Die Kraft, die wir brauchen, wird uns Wotan verleihen. Ihr gabt so viel für dieses Land. Es war der Glaube, der euch verband. Es war der Glaube, der euch verband. höre deine Stimme. Ich glaube, zu mir sprichst. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist es an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimmt im Geiste die Waffen. Ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht,
egal was geschieht,
wir werden bei euch sein. Und kehre ich einst an deinen Stein zurück, berichte ich dir von unserem Glück. Dann ist es geschafft und wir sind wieder frei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, darum ging's mir dabei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, denn jetzt sind wir frei. Ich höre deine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist es an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht,
egal was geschieht,
wir werden bei euch sein.
Deine Stimme,
die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Und bis an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Halt. Wir sind Geiste, die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager on Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. The subject is why we need to get rid of the Holocaust. Not get rid of it, but why it has to go, why it has to end. And that's very much, I guess, like the what Iran has been saying for so long, that about Israel, that Israel has to disappear. And I'm saying it with the same sense, you know, that because Israel never should have been, it was, you know, illegitimate to begin with. And the Holocaust is also illegitimate, and it also has to disappear. So maybe I'll be attacked now in some stronger way than, maybe I'll get attention. I hope not. But I'm going to read go through something from Carla Mattonio that is for the January 27th website. This is just the first half of it that I have here. But before I do, I checked my email, and there's a message from someone named Ali Rashid. Well, that's okay. And he writes, he gives a quote from Arthur Schopenhauer that all truth passes through three stages. Well, that's pretty good for what I've been saying. So I will go through this again. First, it is ridiculed. Now, we've had Holocaust revisionism and being ridiculed. And of course, they call it now Holocaust denial, being ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. It's being violently opposed now. And third, it is accepted as being self-evident. We have to know that we have the truth. If we have the truth, that's the way it goes with the truth. So we can have confidence in that. And he says, thank you to all revisionists, past, present, and future, blessed with the intellect and courage to seek and find the truth. Sincere regards to all. That was very nice, I thought. That's all I have there in the mail. So this is something that Carla Mattonio wrote some time back. It was never translated out of Italian. But now Carlos Porter has translated it. And he's translated a lot of things for Carla Mattonio. And for other people, too. But he's been translating for Carla Mattonio. He's got something else really good. by Jürgen Graf that he wants to translate next. So we'll see how fast it will take him to do it. We might be able to use some of that. Sounds very good. But this one is called 60 Years of Propaganda. And it might be 60 Years of Propaganda Lies, but anyway, I've called it that because I couldn't find the actual title of it again without going hunting around. So I didn't, but that's close enough. And it's very appropriate because he starts out on 27th January 1945. The vanguard of the Soviet 100th Infantry Division, forming part of the 60th Army of the 1st Ukrainian Front, reached the... Oh, there was something else I needed to talk about. I don't think it's going to take me an hour to go through this anyway. I was going to say that I'd welcome phone calls, and the call-in number is 830-443-4911. But there is... let me get that open right now. Let's see. There was something I needed to bring up because, let me find that. Sorry about this. It just slipped my mind this morning. Here it is. I have to make it narrower. Okay. Yeah, I had, on Monday, I had did the Heretics Hour program about the liberation of Auschwitz, and this is in along those same lines. But and someone had I had been saying, and I had it pretty well worked out for myself that there's every reason to believe that the Germans did not blow up the crematoriums, the SS did not blow them up as they left, but it was this, therefore it was the Soviets who did it. Well, then somebody pointed out something from a Carlo Mattogno article at Inconvenient History, and just a couple of lines, and said that there was, and I had made the point, I know strongly, that there were no documents. I have to revise all this. There were no documents showing that the Germans did any of this. But Carlo Mattogno mentioned a document that said, let me get that here. He mentioned a document that, here it is. That said that on the 8th of December, 1944, the end of 44, the head of the Central Construction Office, SS Obersturmführer Werner Jothan, requested prisoner labor employment group for immediate assignment. Got to move this around, of 100 prisoners for the demolition work at the crematorium in Camp 2. That is interpreted as Crematorium 2 in Bear Canal. So, and then that's it. And he sent me the document. I wrote to Carlos, okay, then asking, Carlo Mattogno, asking him about that and telling him what I had believed, and he very nicely answered me and said that, Dear Carolyn, the supposition that the Soviets destroyed the Kremas in Birkenau is, in my opinion, not very tenable. On the one hand, there is at least a document that proves the supposition wrong. So this appears to me to be the only document that he knows of, but it's a good one, but it's, and he sent me a copy of it. And so I see it, and it clearly says exactly what he says. And so there's that. And then he says, on the other hand, a retreating army does not leave intact to the enemy army important facilities. above all cremas, in which, according to them, there were gas chambers which they could use, you know, because they did use, but, well, there's so many things here. I have to agree with him that retreating armies don't leave things behind. And I don't, you know, like, in 1941, when the Germans were going into the Soviet Union, the Soviets were blowing up and destroying everything they could, not leaving anything but burnt earth policy and all that. So you don't leave things like that of any, even of any value behind. And these buildings were of value. As I understand it, the cremation ovens had been removed from these buildings and shipped to Germany. So with that they were taken out, but just the buildings themselves, you know, a lot could be made out of them. As we know, though, they didn't destroy the building in Auschwitz I in the main camp. That's the one that's shown today as a crematorium and gas chamber. And we know that the Soviets they finished it in 1947 anyway. They remodeled that whole thing and changed things around, changed the roof. It was a slanted roof, but that had to be a flat roof so that the officers could walk around on top and dump this Zyklon B through these holes in the roof. So they changed the roof, built a flat roof with holes in it, with, you know, just nice and professional looking, to dump stuff in there. And they rearranged the morgue so that it was just one big empty room, which they then called the gas chamber. And they built this big chimney that's outside of that building, which didn't exist there before. And they failed to attach the chimney to the ovens, to the cremation ovens inside. That's the Russians for you. So that never was done. So there's a lot of reasons not to to understand that was not the way it was when the Germans were there. But the fact is, why didn't they destroy that one? Why did they leave that one behind? Well, I guess there's nobody has an answer for that. But anyway, I respect Carlo's opinion, and I'm sure he's right because of this document. So I have to correct myself in this. And when I in that article that I wrote, I'm going to have to correct my. I've got one on the January 27th website on the liberation. I'm going to have to make some corrections in that. So I really appreciate. I'm glad I went ahead and wrote to him, and I appreciate his writing back to me. And I wanted to mention that on the program, because whenever I'm wrong, I can certainly be wrong, because I like to make big statements. So it's you know, I'm more than willing to admit it and to change my thinking about it. So that's taken care of. Okay, good. Now so Carlo Matonio writes, on January 27, 1945, the vanguard of the Soviet 100th Infantry Division, forming part of the 60th Army of the 1st Ukrainian Front, reached the Auschwitz-Birkenau complex, now abandoned by the SS. The Soviet propaganda machine went to work immediately, echoing the most harebrained stories circulating among the inmates, perhaps through excess of zeal. And what's going to follow here is these harebrained stories. And it's pretty interesting the way he shows how they developed and why and how they grew from, you know, some, and how they began and why they grew the way they did and so on. So we'll see. He says on February 2nd. So there again, you know, they got there. They say they got there on January 27th. But the first things that you ever heard about or knew about or they did were in February. The first few days they didn't like take pictures. You know, as soon as they got there, take these pictures and film these things and put it out there for the public, for the world to see. They did not do that. They took their time. And so on February 2nd, though, Pravda, you know, their own newspaper, which was totally, you know, under the government control, published an article by its correspondent, someone named Boris Polyevoa, entitled The Death Complex at Auschwitz. And in among other things, this article said, they, meaning the Germans, leveled the mounds of so-called old mass graves in the eastern area, blew up and destroyed the traces of their electrical conveyor belt, where hundreds of inmates had been killed simultaneously using electrical current. the bodies were placed on a conveyor belt moving slowly towards a pit furnace where the bodies were burnt completely. So this was the very first thing that they told the Russian people who read Pravda, these wild stories, that this correspondent supposedly heard from the people there and repeated. And this was, you know, it that they, this is where the, right away they had these electrical things. They had electrical conveyor belt. You know, if you ever go and look at the crematorium's, quote, gas chamber, unquote, at Auschwitz, in what they show you now today, that's in Auschwitz 1, with the one with the, all the nice brick buildings. I think they're nice looking. You know, you'll see that it's just this old dungeon. I mean, there's nothing technical there. The most technical thing is that they have these old brick cremation ovens. I think only two of them in there. Yes. And, you know, there's nothing real high tech about those either. Very primitive looking. And that room that's called the gas chamber is just this old, dark old, crummy looking, you know, like somebody's old basement, with nothing in it. Everything's been cleared out. All no walls. The walls that had been there making small rooms, you know, are been taken out. And that's all. So, you know, this whole idea that they're putting across then that they had electrical currents and conveyor belts and so on, and moving things along, moving things from one place to another, just totally fabricated in the imagination. Matonia writes, until this time, Soviet propaganda had never paid much attention to Auschwitz. Pravda, in the preceding months, had only dedicated a few lines to it, reporting, moreover, information received from London, according to which the Auschwitz death factory had three crematoria equipped with gas chambers with a capacity of 10,000 bodies per day. Now, think of that. You see, that's a huge exaggeration. Anyway, even if they had what they say they had, 10,000 bodies you could cremate every day, kill and cremate every day. But this came from London. It didn't come from Auschwitz. The propaganda story repeated by Polyevoa was taken up on 27 September 1945 by a former Auschwitz inmate, a certain Lieberman, who stated as follows. So now they've got this guy Lieberman who's telling the story. He says, as I already said, I belonged to the working party responsible for unloading the potatoes at the station. At that time, we had some contact with the inmates from the big camp. We were put into quarantine, but we were housed together with another working party doing service in the crematorium and gas chamber. That's why I know what happened there. The men and women went into the so-called shower area and got undressed separately to avoid panic. Once they were undressed, they entered the central gas chamber through separate doors. The central gas chamber could hold 3,000 people. The gas was released from the shower heads and from gas bombs thrown through apertures pierced for the purpose. Death occurred in 5 minutes. On some days, when enormous transports arrived at Birkenau station, 42,000 people were gassed. Oh, I have to laugh. Just think about the 42,000 people. Now, they like to tell you that these rooms, they could cram 2,000 people into these shower room, into the morgues at Crematorium 2 and 3 at Birkenau. I don't know when this guy is speaking about, though. Okay, later on. And then less than that in the shower rooms in crematorium 4 and 5. And then it would only take so long, an hour or so to do it, and they could put more in there. But what were they going to do with all these bodies? Even if they could manage to somehow gas that many people, what were they going to do with all these bodies? Which I don't think they could even gas that many people in the time. Anyway, Lieberman continues on. Following completion of the gassing procedure, the floor of the gas chamber opened automatically and the bodies fell into a subterranean chamber where inmates extracted their gold teeth and cut off their hair at a certain length. When the gold teeth had been extracted, the bodies were loaded onto a moving conveyor belt, and here is again a conveyor belt moving them along, and carried to the crematory ovens through underground passageways. Well, there aren't any of those, really. There were 4 ovens, 1 big and 3 small, which had a capacity of 400 bodies in 5 minutes. See? Oh. Then, when the number of bodies exceeded the capacity of the ovens, ditches were dug and the bodies, drenched in oil, were thrown in. I personally saw these trenches and smelt the stench of the combustion. I was also able to visit the gas chambers in crematoria when I was ordered to clean them one day when they were out of use. So he says he's been in there and seen what it looked like. He says, I never personally saw the trolleys for transporting the bodies, nor did I see the ovens in action. But, as I have said, some of the working parties working in the gas chambers and ovens lived with us, and they told me these details. This special group was called the Sonderkommando, or in English, Special Commando. I personally know a certain Jacob Weinschein from Paris, who is a survivor of this commando. That's his story. All right. In 1946, a French governmental publication with reference to a report from the Russian services reported this other version of the same kind of story. They said, 800 to 900 meters from the location of the furnaces, the inmates departed on trolleys traveling on rails. Oops. Got to be careful not to touch that darn thing. Oh, here we go. I'm sorry. Traveling. Okay. Got to go up a little bit more. No, traveling on rails. These rails at Auschwitz were of varying dimensions and contained from 10 to 15 persons. When it was loaded, the trolley was placed in movement along an inclined plane, where it then entered a gallery at high speed. At the end of the gallery, the trolley smashed into a wall. This opened the wall automatically, and the trolley tipped, dumping its human cargo of living beings into the furnace. The trolley was then followed by another, full of another group of inmates, and so on. And notice he says, human cargo of living beings. So they somehow, they put these, bodies, these inmates, into these trolleys, and then just set them off on this high-speed trip, and it was smashed into a wall, opening the wall, and then they were all dumped into a furnace and burnt up. Can you imagine how? And that was in a French publication. Now, according to another hybrid variant of the story, recounted by the former inmate Leo Laptos, the gas chambers, in quotes, were rigged out like shower baths, with shower heads squirting gas, not water, after which, quote, the floor tipped upwards, causing the bodies to fall onto a conveyor belt, which carried them to the crematorium. Now we get into the shower business, the shower room business, but we're still talking about the electrical thing for a little bit here. Even during the war, the propaganda branch of the resistance movement at Auschwitz was busy inventing other, no less fantastic methods of extermination, such as the story of the pneumatic hammer and the electrical chambers and the electrical bath. On 23rd October 1942, this is, you know, still during in the when this propaganda first started, the underground newspaper, which is a Polish name, which means current information, and they had a lot of these Polish underground publications. It was published the following news item. According to the report of an SS employee at the electrical chambers, the number of victims killed daily officially amounted to 2,500 per night. They were killed in the electrical bath and in gas chambers. Well, of course, you know, they say they have a report from an SS employee. They don't name him or anything. I mean, they don't, but they want to make out that they're getting this top secret information from SS who are, or someone who's working for the SS who's telling them things. And a report dated 18 April 1943 attributed these methods of extermination to Auschwitz. One was electrical chambers. These chambers had metallic walls. The victims were pushed inside and the high voltage current was turned on. They had high voltage metallic walls and they just, I don't know what they did, but I don't know how they did it, but I guess it electrocuted them. The other one was the so-called Hammerluft system. This was a pneumatic hammer. There were special chambers in which a hammer fell from the ceiling and the victims died under high air pressure. And I didn't figure that one out either, because if the hammer falls from the ceiling, well, it does something to the air pressure. Anyway, going on, still in May 1945, Mordecai Lichtenstein declared, "The bodies were brought to the crematoria on little trolleys where they were burned by 6,000 volt electrical current." Now, these were all witnesses that were used, that were taken, you know, accepted as having been eyewitnesses, and their testimony was taken seriously. In June 1944, okay, where in the year before the end, at Stockholm, an official of the Polish government in exile, a certain Waszkiewicz interrogated a Pole who had fled Poland after spending 7 weeks in Auschwitz. On 18 June, Waszkiewicz drew up a report in French on the interrogation of the witness, whom he indicated by initials only, KJ. The latter was a conscript worker who had been arrested by the Gestapo upon his return from a few days furlough and was sentenced to 10 weeks in a concentration camp. He was then, you see, sometimes they were arrested for cause, they were guilty of something, they were given a short sentence like that, 10 weeks. He was then interned in Rotwitz camp in Silesia for 3 weeks, after which he was transferred to Auschwitz, where he spent the remaining 7 weeks. In his report on this camp, the witness repeated the fairy tale of the conveyor belt, but in a different context. He said, At every roll call, a special service carried away all those who had fallen where they fell and no longer responded to blows and kicks. This is such a common story, that people just collapse. You know, they're just worked and starved to death. They just collapse, and then the SS come up and kick them and, you know, beat on them for a while, see if they can get any life out of them, and if not, they carry them off. So he goes on saying, without making sure whether they were even really dead, they were transported directly to the crematory oven on a mechanical transporter, the capacity of which in 1943 was designed to handle 1,000 persons at a time. But the most fantastic part of the testimony is this. Section 18 was equipped, that was a Jewish section, was equipped with a gas chamber and a factory manufacturing grease for machinery. And this KJ declares that he had seen how the Germans there transformed the bodies of the gassed Jews into grease, which was then shipped off in packages labeled Schmierstoff Fabrik Auschwitz, means Auschwitz Lubricant Factory. As he was responsible for carrying away the bodies of gassed persons, this testifier, he had been able to observe the process on a group of 1,500 Polish Jews shipped in May 1943. He calls it shipped. Upon their arrival, he says, these Jews were not mistreated, nor did they appear to be particularly ill-nourished. As soon as they arrived, they were made to take a real bath and were even given soap for the purpose. Then afterwards, their clothing was taken away. They were selected, that is, they were grouped separately into fat ones and thin ones, women and men. Every group was then sent to the gas chambers separately, a vast concrete room which was accessed via a triple door. The victims generally died after the doors were closed. The room was then rapidly ventilated, and the inmates responsible for carrying away the bodies were supposed to finish their job as soon as possible before rigor mortis set in. They were carried away on special trolleys, which were carried to the grease factory by means of a special mechanical transporter. There, by means of chemical processes, the nature of which were unknown to KJ. So, you know, here's where they make the leap, you know. There was some chemical processors, but I don't know what they were, but they used these to transform the bodies into pulp, and the grease was extracted. The remains, in the form of a few bones and a shapeless mass, was carefully burned in the crematory oven. After the above, the presentation of Waskiewicz's testimony, he and Montonio comments that he was a genuine forerunner of the present day historians, always prepared to regurgitate the most harebrained eyewitness testimonies without batting an eye, sounds almost comical. He finished by saying, of peasant origins, he's talking about this Waskiewicz, who is telling him this. No, not Waskiewicz. He's talking about this KJ, who's telling him this. Of peasant origins, simple and sometimes primitive, he was without imagination, but an excellent and conscientious observer. His truthfulness appears indisputable. That's what Machonia finds comical. He goes on, Matonio, the fairy tale of the shower heads squirting poison gas instead of water was invented fairly early on. It appears in a letter written in Auschwitz camp dated as early as 29 August 1942, in which we read, the most terrifying thing is the mass executions in gas chambers constructed especially for this purpose. There are two of these, and they can contain 1,200 people. They are equipped with shower baths, unfortunately delivering poison gas instead of water. Matonio writes, in an underground report on living conditions in the camp, dating back to December 1942 or January 1943, that previous one was August 1942, the gassing procedure is described as follows. Now, this is an underground report that went out, you know, that's propaganda they're putting out. From the camps, the inmates are putting it out. On the inside, it says, the chambers are equipped so as to resemble a shower bath, which only differs from real shower baths in the fact that the showers distribute poison gas instead of water. Inside the barracks, they must undress immediately on the pretext that they are going to take a bath. They are even given towels and soap. After their shower, they are supposed to receive underwear and clothing. When the chamber is full, the doors are closed and the gas is emitted through openings designed to look like shower heads. Matonia writes, the imaginary story of the poison gas shower baths immediately received widespread publicity to such an extent that Dr. G.M. Gilbert, the psychologist at the Nuremberg trial, that is the first Nuremberg trial, the one with the major war criminals, even inserted them into the mouth of Rudolf Höss and the commandant of Auschwitz. He had Rudolf Höss saying, according to the psychologist, the killing procedure was easy. There wasn't even any need for guards to make them enter the chambers. They went in expecting to take a shower, and instead of water, we opened the poison gas. The French underground newspaper Fraternité, in its issue for May 1944, published the following eyewitness testimony on Auschwitz. They said, upon arrival, all the men who were still able to work were sent to the work sites immediately. The others, women, children, old people, were sent to the showers. They were taken into a splendid modern building, but instead of showers of warm water, which would have refreshed their tired limbs, they received a spray of gas. And in a few instants, there was nothing left but bodies piled up against the doors through which they had attempted to flee. The bodies of mothers with their children in their arms, or old people clutching their spouses in a supreme gesture of protection. That's from the French underground newspaper Fraternité in 1944. Naturally, Otonio writes, the story of the shower baths was spread far and wide by former camp inmates. Here is an example of Sophia Shafranov's version. She wrote, they faked a shower bath for the victims. Although they knew now just what kind of shower bath it was, they were even given towels and a piece of soap, after which they were made to undress and enter hermetically sealed concrete chambers. The ceiling was decked out with shower heads, which emitted poison gas instead of water. The most fantastic version of the shower bath fairy tale was invented by Ada Bimko, a Polish Jew deported to Auschwitz on 4 August 1943, and who testified as follows under oath at the Belsen trial. In August 1944, she had not, this is still Matonio writing, no, this is the whoever, this is whoever's writing about this, Ada Bimko. It's not her speaking yet. In August 1944, Ada Bimko had been compelled to enter a gas chamber at Birkenau to remove an alleged gas chamber at Birkenau to remove blankets, which wouldn't have been in there, but anyway, that's what it says, which had allegedly been left there by the gassing victims. She had hardly entered when she had the immense good luck to meet an inmate member of the so-called Sonderkommando from the same city, I guess the same city she was from, after which a very agreeable SS non-commissioned officer hurriedly showed her the top-secret extermination gassing installations. And this is her description that she gave. In the first room, I saw a man who came from the same city as I did. There was also an SS man with the rank of Unterscharfuhrer who belonged to the Red Cross. So he was an SS, but he was functioning for the Red Cross or something like that, according to her. I was told that the people left their clothes in the first big room and that they were taken from this room into another, and I had the impression that hundreds and hundreds of people could fit into this room. It was so big. It looked like a shower bath or the bathing rooms we had at the camp. There were large numbers of shower heads on the ceiling in parallel rows. Everybody who entered this room was given a towel and a bar of soap, so as to give them the impression that they were about to take a shower. But anybody who looked at the floor could see that it wasn't true, because there were... Because there were no... Because there were no exit drains for the water. This room also had a little door, which led to a very dark room, which looked like a corridor. I saw lines of rails with a little trolley, which they called a truck, and I was told that the prisoners who had already been gassed were placed on these trolleys and sent straight to the crematoria. I believe that the crematorium was located in the same building, but I didn't see the ovens. There was also a room higher than the other by a few steps with a very low ceiling, and I saw two pipes, which, as I was told, contained the gas. There were also two enormous metallic containers that contained the gas. In a deposition annexed to the trial records. Now, you know, she testified, this is her part of her testimony, at the trial of Joseph Kramer and 44 others, which is called the Belson trial. That poor Joseph Kramer, you know, he got stuck being there at Dachau at the end, and boy, they really did a number on him. I feel so sorry for him. He was the new commandant. He hadn't been there very long, and he got blamed for everything. Anyway, that's where this testimony is from. Now, it says, in a deposition annexed to the trial records, Ada Bimko stated, the SS told me that the cylinders contained the gas, and see, these SS are telling her everything, which went through the pipes into the gas chamber. Therefore, the gas traveled from the containers into the pipes and through the shower heads into the gas chamber. But even this story had its variants, Antonio says. One particularly extravagant variant was recounted by Bruno Piazza, who had been sentenced to death in the gas chamber, according to him, from which he miraculously managed to save himself. He said, I heard one of them say, crematorium. We continued marching through the camp between two rows of barracks of a type quite similar to those of the last camp. When we got to the end, they made us turn left and then made us enter a barracks in semi-darkness, all 800 of us. Night had already fallen. In the middle, there was a stove that had gone out and three ship's buckets of zinc. Now, I don't know. I guess a ship's bucket is a large bucket. I don't know what zinc looks like. They mean maybe zinc powder, perhaps, a zinc powder. Anyway, suddenly, they turned on the lights, and we saw that we were in a sort of shower room. There were 20 shower heads on the ceiling. Now, he counted them. He counted the shower heads on the ceiling, I guess. This room, the antechamber of the crematorium, was the gas chamber. No doubt of it now. I had heard talk of the system. They put a white layer of potassium cyanide powder underneath the shower, I guess where the shower heads were, and then suddenly turned on the water. This caused the release of deadly poisonous cyanide gas. So this time they had actual water in there, in the shower head, in the showers, but also potassium cyanide powder. Then the clerk, and that's a funny name, it says, you know, sick. There's a wrong term, clerk, but anyway, he said, then the clerk entered with a mask on his face, sprinkled the powder, turned on the shower, left, closed the door, and after 10 minutes, they were all dead, asphyxiated. Now, he says they. You know, at first he was with these people. No, this is where he's saying he had heard about the system. This is how the system worked. Okay. He says, at the other end of the room was a high door, which was said to lead to the crematorium by means of an inclined plane. Then he goes on, in the past, asphyxia had been achieved using a different method from the current one with the showers. A hole was pierced in the ceiling. The hole was opened by an automatic valve, injecting three or four pre-prepared cyanide gas cylinders into the interior of the chamber. But the system was not very safe, because sometimes the cover of the cylinder wasn't broken in the fall, and it was then necessary to repeat the procedure four or five times to be sure that the gas had actually been emitted into the chamber. So he's saying that they've got these closed cylinders, gas cylinders, and they drop them down into the room from the roof and expect that the top, that it's going to break in the fall, or the top's going to come off or something. But if it doesn't, then it doesn't work. They have to do it again and again. That sounds like some way the Germans would be doing things, doesn't it? At the Degesch trial, now Degesch is the company that makes the Zyklon B, for one thing. And they were put on trial too in 1949. They put all that whole company on trial for manufacturing a perfectly legal pesticide that was necessary for killing lice and so on, that was used in all the camps for clothing and bedding and anything that needed to be disinfected from these pests. Anyway, at this Degesh trial in 1949, a witness mentioned the rumor that at Birkenau, the gas was introduced into the chamber through fake shower heads. Now, this is really good. But both Dr. Helly, the inventor of Cyclone B, and Dr. Ra, a physicist, declared that this gassing technique was impossible, so that the High Court of Frankfurt am Main, in its judgment of 28th March 1949, acknowledged that it was incorrect. They said, the tribunal does not doubt the fact that the hypothesis that the gas was emitted from a tin can of Zyklon B by means of a tap and introduced into the gas chamber is erroneous, so that it is no longer necessary to perform the experiment requested by one of the defendants. Very funny. See, one of the defendants apparently asked for this gassing technique to be demonstrated. But now, you know, they're careful in their language. They don't want to say too much. But, you know, what these experts, inventor of Zyklon B and a physicist, said was that this way of that you couldn't introduce gas into some pipes or something and it comes out of a shower. Through, you know, out of shower heads. They said this was impossible to do this. And so because the court couldn't, you know, because these witnesses were there, because it was the trial of the company that made these products, so they were able to have witnesses like this, they had to back down. And they said that this was not possible. So that meant that all these stories about gas coming out of showers are not true, you know, right there. Matonio goes on, the story of the cylinders of hydrocyanic acid was an adaptation of the more commonly heard version of the bombs containing hydrocyanic acid, which was invented towards the end of 1943. And the beginning of 1944 by Jerzy Tabo, it's a Polish word, name, who was interned at Auschwitz under the name of Jerzy Wisowski on 23rd March 1942 and escaped on the night of 19th and 20th November 1943. In his report, which began circulating in the summer of 1944, he wrote, after reaching the area with the gas chamber in it, which was surrounded by barbed wire, the condemned men had to undress completely, men, women, and children together. Each person received a towel and some soap. They were then all crammed into the chamber with plenty of blows and mistreatment. This is how the chamber was filled with as many people as it could hold, after which the door was closed tight, and SS men were assigned for the purpose. Who were assigned for the purpose, poured the bombs, which were filled with prussic acid, through the valves located in the walls. This one had valves in the walls. After 10 minutes, the doors were opened. 10 minutes. And a special commando, always made up of Jews, carried away the bodies and made room for the next convoy. So after 10 minutes, they opened the doors after these people were poisoned and carried away the bodies. A report dated 23rd August 1944, by contrast, mentioned ampules. Under the pretext of visiting a shower bath, they make the people undress, give them soap, and send them to the shower area, where they close the doors airtight, after which they throw the ampules inside full of an unknown liquid. The ampules break and release the gas, which causes their death within 5 or 10 minutes. Again, they like to speak about these short times. It doesn't take any time at all. This fantastic story was also echoed by Kurt Gerstein. Kurt Gerstein, you know, that former SS guy that turned bad and told all these stories and wrote this book, who wrote that the Dagesh director had told him, now this will be a lie, the Dagesh director had told him that for the killing of men, he had supplied, now this, he's saying that this Dagesh director is admitting that he was supplying stuff for killing men. He had supplied hydrocyanic acid and ampules. However, according to him, according to Gerstein, at Auschwitz, these ampules were used in a different manner. Only at Auschwitz, this guy supposedly said, were millions of children, or maybe it was Gerstein said, only at Auschwitz were millions of children killed by holding a wad soaked with hydrocyanic acid underneath their noses. So did they hold it themselves? Did somebody hold it there? I don't know. In addition to bombs or cylinders or ampules of hydrocyanic acid, other substances were indicated as methods of extermination. Some of these were sternutory gases, in German, gas sternutatores, I don't know what that is, and I didn't look it up, and a certain substance which puts the victims to sleep, Einschlafern, in 1 minute. So they had these two things, sternutory gases and something to put them to sleep in 1 minute. I don't know if they mean death sleep or just sleep, but ex-inmate Otto Wolken, by contrast, spoke of gassing ditches. Now, this is good. He said, quote, ditches were dug and covered with canvas, serving as provisional gas chambers. Can you imagine? So they dig some ditches, they put canvas over them, then they put these people in there, they put the Jews in there, in the ditch, and then, they, you know, because it's covered, they put some gas in there, and they're gassed in these ditches. Okay, now we go to another thing, the atomic bomb. At the Nuremberg trial on 21st June 1946, during the trial, the tribunal, the American prosecutor Jackson, what's his first name? Anyway, you know, the top American prosecutor, the Supreme Court Justice Jackson, mentioned another method of alleged extermination in the vicinity of Auschwitz, the atomic bomb. So Jackson is talking about, is saying this. This is him. Quote, a small village was provisionally erected with temporary structures, and in it approximately 20,000 Jews were put. By means of this newly invented weapon of destruction, these 20,000 people were eradicated almost instantaneously and in such a way that there was no trace left of them. That it developed, the explosive developed, temperatures of from 400 to 500 degrees centigrade and destroyed them without leaving any trace at all. So not only did they use an atomic bomb, according to this, just to kill 20,000 Jews, and out of all the millions they supposedly killed, this was not much, but they built this whole village in order to send them there to do it. And then this bomb left no trace of anything. Everything just disappeared. Pretty good, huh? As we may see, the Americans, Matonio says, to put it in a nutshell, had the bad habit of imputing their own crimes to their enemies of the moment. It was the Americans who used the atomic bomb, but they wanted to say the Germans had done it first. These fairy tales quickly fell into oblivion, being replaced by other better organized fairy tales, which we will examine in paragraph 3, but not without causing a certain disconcertment among the Holocaust historians. The latter, after all, were then compelled to proclaim that it was not these propaganda fairy tales that developed through various literary elaborations into the Holocaust truth, which reigns supreme for the moment, but rather that such tales were a simple reflection of the latter truth, at that time unknown or ignored. Okay, so, you know, they're trying to say now that all these ridiculous statements by these so-called witnesses reflected the truth that they didn't really understand at the time, or were being ignored. But that's the best they can come up with, I guess. So he says, he's going on to another section here. Section 2, the lie of the industrial exploitation of human corpses. And I'll just kind of paraphrase this because there's something, I think you mentioned already, the Auschwitz lubricant factory where they were taking grease from the bodies. Well, now there's this thing that they're taking, extracting grease from the bones, saying that that they had these bones left over from the cremation. And so they had this method, undisclosed, but this method of extracting grease from these bones. And they were actually extracting so much grease from these bones that they were packaging it up and shipping it and using it, shipping it out and using it as industrial grease for their industry, the Germans. And here he says that the study of the origins of this particular grease lie is important because it shows clearly the manner in which the Auschwitz propagandists elaborated their fairy tales, starting with a particle of truth, but distorting it so as to be able to invest it with a terrible criminal significance. That's how they did it. They'd start with something that was true, like, you know, after cremation you have bones, right? And then trying to make out that some terrible criminal thing had taken place. Because, according to, Latonio, they were taking grease from the bones, extracting grease from bones to improve the diet of the inmates. You know, there was never enough fat in the diet of the Germans. They had a hard time. That's why butter was like, you know, very hard to get in a little bit. The Germans were suffering from not enough fat in their diet. And, so would be the prisoners too in the concentration camps and so on. So they are always trying to add some fat. And so in this case, they were trying to add this stuff from the bones, to the diet, to their food, but not, they didn't make it into an industrial product, which is what the stories turned out to be. And, it says, okay, we've got 60 seconds, ladies and gentlemen. Now, I guess I won't try to cram any more in here. Anyway, it's quite funny, you know, when he's writing about this, where they sent these bones, they supposedly shipped these bones to some big lubricant company and so on. It goes on quite a bit, but I didn't get that in. Well, you will find it. You will come across it later. So I want to thank you for listening today. That's my program for now. For today, today's Saturday afternoon program. If you have anything to offer for the January 27th commemoration website, please go ahead and let me know about it, and we'll see. Time is getting very short, you know, but it's time now to begin talking about it. So I'm talking about it, and I hope you will be talking about it too. Thanks. Good night. Good day. Good afternoon. Have a nice weekend, and I will see you again on Monday.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.